Oyez, 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 the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God bless the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. The American Tobacco Company, Incorporated versus Jeannie Grinnell and others from Jefferson County, and Columbia Gas Transmission Corporation versus New Ulm Gas Limited from Austin County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being tape recorded for the court's convenience. If you would like to purchase a tape of the argument, you may make application with the clerk of our court. Justice Owen is recused in the first cause, but will be sitting in the second cause. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of the arguments. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in the first cause.
May it please the court, Mr. Sam Cruz will present argument from petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes.
May it please the court, I'm Sam Cruz from Cruz Scott in Houston. I represent the petitioner, the American Tobacco Company, in this case. This is a product liability case where the decedent, Wiley Grinnell, smoked cigarettes for over 30 years. In 1985, Mr. Grinnell developed lung cancer, and he died in 1986. A product liability action was filed in Jefferson County, alleging, among other things, that Mr. Grinnell was unaware of the harmful effects of smoking, and that if he had been warned about these effects and dangers of smoking, he would have heeded those warnings, and he would not have smoked and thereby avoided his injuries and death. The trial court granted summary judgment, and it was appealed to the Beaumont Court of Appeals. The Beaumont Court of Appeals reversed, and we're asking this court to reverse the decision of the Beaumont Court of Appeals and render a judgment in favor of America. Our application for writ of error was granted on all three points, and I'm going to talk about our first point of error initially, which deals with the error of the Beaumont Court of Appeals in finding that there was a fact issue regarding whether or not the harmful effects of smoking were common knowledge within the community. Now, in its decision, the Beaumont Court of Appeals held that there was a fact issue on whether or not the harmful effects of smoking were common knowledge because they said that Wiley Grinnell, the plaintiff in the case, said that he was unaware of those risks. And as this court knows, under the Shears decision and under Seagram's, that is the wrong test. When you're looking to determine common knowledge in the community, it's an objective standard, as this court said in Shears. You look as to what the community knows about common knowledge, and what the individual plaintiff says is not determinative, or as the court in Morris holds, it's irrelevant. So the Beaumont court erred in determining there was a fact issue on the common knowledge doctrine by looking to what Mr. Grinnell said he knew or didn't know about the particular risk. The Beaumont court also erred in distinguishing this court's opinion in the Seagram's case and in holding that comments I and J to Section 402A of the Restatement of Torts did not apply to a tobacco case because, as the Beaumont court put it, tobacco has only been around since 1850 and alcohol has been around since ancient times.
Counsel, do you know when comments I and J were added to 402A?
Excuse me, Justice Abbott?
Do you know when comments I and J were added to 402A?
Today? No, I do not.
So you don't know if they were there before he started smoking?
Well, the restatement was drafted in 1961 and it was adopted in 1963. Comments I and J would have been in there then, but he started smoking in 1952. But when you look at comments I and J about what they say and what I'm going to talk about later, they do not say this only applies to people that started smoking after this date. They do not say they apply only to people who smoked in 66, 52, 53, they just say that...
I understand, but one perception could be that when I and J were written,
then it was common knowledge perhaps at that time that smoking was hazardous to your health. The issue is, or possibly could be, whether or not it was hazardous at the time that the plaintiff in this case started smoking.
That would be the issue, Justice Abbott, but I think when you look at comment I, in particular comment I, which holds that the harmful effects of smoking were common knowledge within the community, and that's why tobacco is not unreasonably dangerous, I don't think there's any limitation on it. I think it applies retroactively, and it doesn't say otherwise.
How are we to apply any kind of test or any kind of determination as to when something becomes common knowledge? In other words, it seems as though most people today realize that smoking is hazardous to your health. At some point in time in history, though, that was not common knowledge. And at what time did it become common knowledge?
Well, we're talking about 1952 when Mr. Grinnell began smoking, and so you need, from the common knowledge standpoint, to look at things such as the restatement, the matters that we've cited in our brief. You can look to case law. There's the Paul decision, which is out of Ohio. There, in that case, and it's the same cause of actions as this case, the smoker began in 1940 and developed lung cancer and emphysema. And in that case, the Paul Court addressed comment I and the common knowledge standard, and they held that the dangers posed by tobacco smoking have long been within the ordinary common knowledge to the community, and that comment I to the restatement of torts, 402A, specifically mentions tobacco as a product that is not defective. And then they went on to say, the common knowledge standard does not raise a question of fact for a jury, and that an individual's personal knowledge or lack of knowledge about the dangers of smoking is irrelevant. And that was a case where the smoker began in 1940. So I think this is one of the authorities that this court can look to in determining common knowledge as far back as 1952. We've cited other cases, as well as comment I and other incidences that this court can use, including the testimony of the plaintiff's own expert witness, Dr. Ravenholt, who testified that any reasonable, intelligent adult from 1950 on would have been aware that smoking causes lung cancer, and that'd be a transcript 1207 at 324 through 326 of his deposition.
If that's true, then you would be entitled to prevail, you say, on the strict liability claims.
Under the Munoz case, yes.
But that would not necessarily apply to the fraud claim, for example, would it?
Well, in the Seagram's case, it did apply to the fraud claims. They had a fraud cause of action in that as well. And to the extent that the dangers of smoking are common knowledge in the community, there wouldn't be any reliance or something to support a fraud claim, so it would dismiss a fraud claim.
You're arguing for an objective standard for common
yes.
knowledge in the 402A context, but Mr. Grinnell could subjectively believe the advertising claims of your client, and your client be subject to a fraud claim, could it not?
I don't think so under Sears, but you don't really even have to get to that, because in our alternative grounds for summary judgment, there is absolutely no showing in the summary judgment record that Mr. Grinnell ever relied on any cigarette advertisement or statement from American in beginning to smoke cigarettes or in continuing to smoke cigarettes or switch brands. The evidence is all that he began because his friends gave him cigarettes, and he switched brands because of taste.
So but insofar as the claim, your client takes the position that the Surgeon General's determination that cigarette smoking is dangerous to one's health, your client takes a contrary position, does it not?
Our client takes the position that there has long been within the community common knowledge that lung cancer is associated with smoking cigarettes, and we have the testimony of Mr. Hyman, which says it goes back, it's 25 years, and he was deposed over 5 years, so that'd be 30 years.
Well, let me ask you, try to be a little more straightforward.
Right.
Does your client agree or disagree that cigarette smoking is dangerous to one's health?
Our client agrees that there is a risk factor in smoking cigarettes.
Rendering it dangerous to one's health?
There's a risk factor from a statistical standpoint. We do not agree that smoking causes lung cancer because we don't know. The testimony in this case shows that what makes a cell, a normal cell, go from being non-cancerous to cancerous, the scientists don't know. Their own experts testified to that in the record in this case. Further, 90% of the people who smoke do not get lung cancer, and people who do not smoke get lung cancer. From a strict scientific causation standpoint, we do not agree or say that it causes it for the reasons that I've just stated.
So if Mr. Grinnell believed your client's advertising that the claims of dangerousness were unfounded, scientifically unfounded, and continued to smoke in reliance upon that, that could subject your client to a fraud claim if there were appropriate evidence in this record.
But there is no such evidence in this case that there was that type of advertising.
I'm asking you as a legal proposition, that would be a viable fraud claim. Your only point is that there's no evidence in the summary judgment record to support that claim.
That's my position.
Is it your position that it's not only harmful, but that there is common knowledge that it's addictive?
Your Honor, it's our position that common knowledge would include the risk of addiction, the same as it includes any harmful effects of smoking, as is discussed in comment I.
And there's no difference between harmful, perhaps someone develops a cough, and harmful, someone develops cancer. There's no difference there.
I don't really follow there, Justice Spencer.
Well, the common knowledge, perhaps, that it's harmful, in your view, also includes that it may cause cancer as well as lesser afflictions.
It would be the risk of anything inherent in the use of the product, which would include what you just said.
As well as addiction.
It would also include addiction, but addiction was also addressed in the Seagram's case. In that case, they were claiming addiction, and I think this court discussed it, or at least mentioned it in its opinion, but in determining common knowledge, addiction didn't play a part in that. Further, again, comments I and J do not say that they apply to someone who says that they were unable or couldn't stop smoking. And as I said, this was addressed also in the Seagram's case.
Mr. Cruz, you predicate a lot of your argument on comments I and J of your statement. Professor Keaton talked in terms of I and J and how it sort of covered alcohol and some other things, and it sort of compared good penicillin, good cigarettes, and good whiskey, meaning that here's stuff that's for normal consumption by folks, and there's not going to be liability if there's common knowledge that that normal consumption carries some risk to it. But it seems to me under I and J, they both are presuming that the risk of the use comes from either overconsumption or long-term usage, and it's this overconsumption and long-term usage that's the common knowledge. It seems to not include products that are dangerous just from use, as opposed to overconsumption or long-term usage.
I think comment J talks about overconsumption and long-term usage, Your Honor, but comment I deals with products which have risks that are inherent in them, which are well-known dangers within the community, and for that reason they're not unreasonably dangerous. And that is where I think this court can find, from a common knowledge standpoint, that the harmful effects of smoking, and particularly the risk of lung cancer, would apply to this case. And I think when you look, as we have...
Well, let me follow up on that. So if there's just an inherent risk that's common knowledge, then use this. Arsenic. Arsenic is known to be a poison that kills people, but arsenic is also seems to me to be commonly known that if you use it in just a small enough dosage, it doesn't have an immediate effect, but over time it accumulates until ultimately you die. But arsenic commonly known to be a poison, don't take it. If a company manufactured arsenic for human consumption, put it up on the shelf and retailed it,
does 402A comment I and J insulate the manufacturer of that product because the risk of simply using it is the risk that is commonly known, it's insulated from its liability for manufacturing that product.
You kind of lost me there, and I apologize. I think, may I talk about tobacco?
You can talk about tobacco.
All right. The risk or the common knowledge with respect to tobacco, according to the people who drafted the restatement, which would include comments I and comments J, were that when you have a product for personal use or enjoyment, which would distinguish between the arsenic example that you just used, and the dangers are well known within the community, those products are not unreasonably dangerous, and those products should not be subjected to strict liability.
But
that's why
those,
tobacco was listed. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Aren't those comments, though, predicated on a notion of distinguishing between, like, good cigarettes as opposed to bad cigarettes?
That's exactly right. It talks about good tobacco is not unreasonably dangerous merely because there are harmful effects of smoking. And then it goes further and says what would not be good tobacco. It says if marijuana is in tobacco, that would not be, that may be unreasonably dangerous. What they're talking about is an ingredient or something getting into a cigarette that doesn't belong in the cigarette, as opposed to something, an ingredient or something that is normally in a cigarette. That's the distinction, I think, that you have to look at in terms of the intent of the people who drafted those comments.
So going back to my hypothetical of arsenic that someone chooses to use because they enjoy it, that as long as it's just like all other compounds, that it doesn't have some sort of adulteration that makes it different, then comment I would say as long as it's commonly known to be harmful, then the mere manufacturing of it can't create any sort of liability of that product.
If I understand your example, if someone went and bought arsenic and ate it for whatever reason, because they wanted to do it and died from it right then, I don't think they would have a claim against the manufacturer.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Please report. My name is David Galtling with the law firm of Mahaffey and Weber in Beaumont, and I represent the family of Wiley Grinnell Jr., whose death from small cell lung cancer was caused by his lifetime of addiction to defendant's product, which was a Pall Mall cigarette, extra long, non-filtered cigarette, which he smoked throughout from his early teen years. His friend says he started at age 14 or 15. He says at a later time at age 18, but in his teen years, the Surgeon General in the Nicotine Addiction Report has stated that that is typically when the addiction begins, when tobacco addiction begins, and that is when his addiction, when his use of tobacco began. The American Tobacco Company takes two positions on the central issue here. That is, what was common knowledge in 1950 concerning the harm caused by their product? One position they take to this court and to the trial court, that it was common knowledge in the 1950s that their product causes addiction, lung cancer, and death. The other position is the position they take to the smoking public, their consumers. And that is the position that is reflected in the documents that I presented to the court this morning that are in the record. They are exhibits to Dr. Ravenholt's deposition, whom counsel referred to earlier.
Don't you think of the position that this particular defendant took to the general public was pretty ineffective because the general public did discover that smoking was bad for your health? So doesn't it seem as though whatever position that the defendant took in this case is irrelevant to the issue of common knowledge? Common knowledge can exist regardless of what the tobacco maker may have said either directly to this particular individual or to the public at large.
Common knowledge was affected in 1950s by the public statements of the American Tobacco Company and by the tobacco industry in general. They were attempting to influence the knowledge of the public, particularly the knowledge of the smoking public.
And they were ineffective at influencing the knowledge of the public because the public knew at some point in time that it was bad for your health.
The deposition testimony that counsel referred to from our expert, he was asked whether or not the studies that came out in 1950 were public knowledge, were common knowledge. His response was very specific, that they would have been common knowledge to segments of the medical community, to the principals of the tobacco company, but that he could not speak with particularity with respect to the rest of the population, although he did say a reasonably intelligent adult would be aware of the studies. But his point was, he was not addressing the issue of whether it was common knowledge that cigarettes caused lung cancer. He was addressing the issue of whether or not it was common, whether the studies were known. And his point, his answer was, with ongoing controversy. And that is it. The tobacco companies created the ongoing controversy. And they did it for a reason, to maintain their cigarette market. They came out with continuous public statements assuring the public, the smokers, that their product was not injurious to health. And I think that if the court would look at their 1954, first of all, the American Tobacco Company was the first company to take this position.
They let me ask you a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it your position that the common knowledge doctrine applies only in one time frame, and that's 1950 when Mr. Grinnell started smoking, that you don't ever apply it later on when common knowledge changes? For instance, it's 1969. What was common knowledge in 1969?
Your Honor, I agree that knowledge, scientific knowledge, changes. What happened to Mr. Grinnell?
So if in 1969 there is a common knowledge that it causes lung cancer, but Mr. Grinnell continued to smoke, where is your position?
I would not agree, Your Honor, that, well, first of all, let me address what happened to Mr. Grinnell, and if I could address the common knowledge issue. But first, what happened to Mr. Grinnell, and we've got expert testimony on this, is that he became addicted. And at that point, we have testimony from one of the four editors to the 1988 Surgeon General's report on nicotine addiction, which was issued.
Still doesn't answer the common knowledge issue, does it?
It answers the issue of whether or not he could quit smoking, Your Honor, despite what the public knew. And the point is that In 1960s, 70s, and 80s, he was heavily addicted to tobacco. He was heavily addicted. One of the four contributors that was appointed by the Surgeon General to study nicotine addiction, Dr. Benowitz, testified to that effect, that he could not quit without intensive intervention. Dr. Grabowski with UT Medical Center, with the director of the Behavioral Health Science Center in Houston, has testified in this case that he could not quit smoking, that Mr. Grinnell was addicted, that nicotine is an addictive substance, similar to cocaine, similar to heroin, and its difficulty of quitting. Some people quit. Some people quit cocaine. He was unable to quit. His addiction killed him. This product killed him. And we simply ask that we be given an opportunity to present that issue to a jury in this case. This is a summary judgment case. Is there a fact issue which should be submitted to the jury?
But do you agree with their characterization of the common knowledge doctrine, that the subjective viewpoint of the victim is not relevant when you apply it?
I don't agree.
Objective standard.
I don't agree that it's not relevant. I agree that it's not determinative, which is the language that this court used in the Caterpillar versus Shear case. The Caterpillar Shear case decided last year talked in terms of an objective standard. I think it's relevant evidence. I think it is, as the court said, an objective standard. But we can look at the information that the American Tobacco Company, that is in the record, that shows what they were saying about...
Well, I understand that, but that's a different issue. That goes to your fraud or fraudulent concealment, but we're still on the common knowledge doctrine.
Well,
if I could answer my question, you say that there's no moving target on it because your client was addicted. So that
dispenses with common knowledge as far as his particular case is concerned. Is that your position?
Well, I think, as Mr. Cruz said, the issue is common knowledge at the time he started smoking in the 1950s.
So it doesn't move any further than that?
Well, it may move in a particular case, Your Honor. In this particular case, there was no warning at all on cigarettes in the 1950s. And at the time he got addicted.
But there was in 1966.
But at that point, Your Honor, he was addicted. And at that point, Your Honor, there is testimony in the record, unequivocal testimony in the record from experts, three of them. Dr. Ravenholt, who said he could not make a rational choice to quit smoking. Dr. Borowski, Dr. Benowitz, that he was addicted to the product. Now, if I could, Your Honor, after they issued their press release in 1953 saying our product's not injurious to health, and after they went with the rest of the industry, and I say the American Tobacco Company was the first tobacco company to come forward with a press release saying it was not injurious to health, they then got with the industry, organized, and made a frank statement to smokers saying the exact same thing, that their product is safe, not injurious to health. Their research and development director in this case today testified in our case that these products are safe. Their position today is the same as it was in 1953. In their 1954 report, Your Honor, they said something which sounds very much like common knowledge. They say, it's the fourth page on it, they say, common sense is beginning to prevail. It's working. What they're doing is working. Supported by the opinions of reputable medical scientists, the public generally is coming to realize that no real case has been proved against tobacco.
Is that true?
That is what the evidence was, Your Honor.
Is that true?
There was a controversy. That is correct.
I mean, is it true that no real case has been shown and the public really doesn't think that they're much of a health problem?
There are two statements there. At that time, one out of every two adult males was smoking cigarettes, and there was a controversy about whether it caused harm. So it was not common knowledge. It was a disputed fact. It was not a disputed fact among those medical scientists and among the principals in the tobacco company. They knew what they were doing. They were committing, to use Justice Cornyn's phrase, fraud. They intentionally deceived the American public with these statements.
But I assume you will agree that whether they did that or not, what the public thinks about the health hazards of smoking is independent of whatever position the defendant or anybody else might take in this lawsuit.
It's not independent in the sense that they were trying to control that knowledge, and they did.
And that's germane to your fraud claim, I suppose.
It's germane also to the warning claim. That is, they created a controversy. It cannot be said that it was an undisputed fact. And that's the distinction between this case and McGuire.
Concerning the warning claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why doesn't that run into Cipollone?
Okay, Cipollone. In Cipollone, if I could come back to McGuire later, but if I could address Cipollone now, Your Honor. Cipollone, the U.S. Supreme Court clearly has set forth what the law is on preemption. I mean, we don't have to go beyond that decision, but...
Why doesn't that preempt your warning claim?
Because the court held that it did not. In other words, the court held that the 1965 Act, which are the two orders that are involved in this case, preempted nothing. It was a 7-2 decision on that issue. On the 1969 Act, however, they said only that failure to warn claims after 1969 were preempted. At that point, our client was addicted and had been addicted for 10 years. He could not quit. Our claim is that there was a failure to warn in the 50s. So if I could come back to McGuire, the distinction McGuire, which is what the trial court did, was rely on McGuire. The trial court denied their motion for summary judgment, raising all these other issues before McGuire came out. When McGuire came out, they renewed it, he granted it. And he granted it on the common knowledge issue. And he said that on the record. Now, the difference between McGuire here is that there's a fact issue on what was common knowledge. It was a disputed fact. In McGuire, the court clearly pointed out that it was dealing only with a duty to warn case. It set that forth in the first sentence of the opinion. We're looking at a duty to warn case. And it said, in this case, later on in the opinion, the alcohol company admits that alcoholism results from alcohol. Mr. Cruz just told the court that he does not admit that cigarettes cause lung cancer. They won't admit it today. So it is a disputed fact. It is a fact which needs to be submitted to the jury. This is a summary judgment case that we should be entitled to present to a jury to determine the fact issues.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about the fraud. First of all, do you agree that there is no evidence of reliance?
Your Honor, that, first of all, he said that he saw statements that there was no proof that caused lung cancer. Now, he said he saw them in the 70s and 80s.
But were those statements by American Tobacco Company?
He said he thought they, one of them was.
And
I asked him further, he said, was it possible it was some other company? And he said, well, possible. He's deceased now, we can't further that, but his testimony was that he thought that it was the American Tobacco Company's, and I believe R.J. Reynolds' statements that he saw.
And with regard to the fraud and fraudulent misrepresentation claims, didn't this court reject similar claims in McGuire under facts even more compelling?
Well, if I read the McGuire case correctly, Your Honor, the last statement was, in these limited circumstances in this particular case, and the court also started off by saying we're dealing with a duty to warn case. And I read McGuire as addressing common knowledge in terms of a warning case, not in terms of a fraud case. Now, if I could move on to another issue, which is evidence of a less dangerous design. And there is evidence of that in this case. We produced evidence from Dr. Ravenholt that they could have put a filter on it, that they could have reduced the tar and nicotine, that they could have reduced the carcinogens, that they could have done things which would have substantially lessened, to use his language, the chances that Mr. Grinnell would have been harmed and gotten lung cancer.
Can they do that in other brands that American Tobacco produced?
They do sell filter brands, Your Honor. In fact, they advertise this one as having a filter. I mean, it's filtering. And their marketing research said that people believe
that. So there's a reasonable deduction that Mr. Grinnell could have changed to take advantage of the alternate design?
Well,
but chose not to for whatever his own reasons were.
They manufactured a product which is the only product we're dealing with in this case, Your Honor, that caused this harm.
No, but your argument now is that they didn't offer a safer alternate design, and that's not what the facts are. Is that correct?
Well, they did not make this design safe. They sold an unreasonably dangerous, and I'm not saying that they could have made a, quote, safe. I'm saying what Dr. Ravenholt said, that they could have made a less dangerous design.
But isn't their answer that we did, but your client chose not to take advantage of it?
But with the particular product that they sold to him.
No, he bought it. It was offered, but he bought it.
And they offered it with the statement that tobacco is its own best filter.
Well, I understand that goes back to Judge Abbott's question. It has to do with your fraud allegations, doesn't it?
But it also has to do with what he thought he was getting. And the fact is that they know that their advertising penetrated because they did motivation studies afterwards. And they said, people say, you know, we're finding out that people are saying that this product filters, that this has filtration quality.
Wasn't there some evidence in the record that even offered and given filtered cigarettes by friends that he tore the filter off?
I think at the point that he was addicted, there is evidence of that, Your Honor. There's evidence of a number of different fact issues.
So then is the bottom line of your argument is the addictive nature of the product is the whole cause of this claim?
It is a substantial part of the claim.
Your position is there's no safe cigarette, right?
My own personal position is that there's
no. No, I'm asking about your client's position.
I don't think there is a safe cigarette, Your Honor. I think that there are less dangerous cigarettes which could have reduced the risk. And I don't think they did anything to attempt to do that. I think they, in effect, the evidence is that they fumigated the product with acryl nitrile, which is a carcinogen. That is our manufacturing claim, that they added a flavoring, which was an animal carcinogen, that they were aware of polonium-210, which is a carcinogen that they could have filtered out, that they did nothing, that they know how since the 40s and 50s. There's a memo on the record and attached to Dr. Ravenholt's testimony that shows that in the 40s and 50s they knew how to reduce the levels of nicotine, that the technology was available. They did nothing on that. In effect, we're dealing with an unreasonably dangerous product. The question here is not whether the jury is not going to be asked, are all cigarettes unreasonably dangerous? the jury, I think, should be asked, is this product, which defendant sold, marketed, and had about 15% of the market at that time, was it unreasonably dangerous? And did it cause the harm, in this case, the addiction and the lung cancer and the death of Mr. Grinnell? I think the position in this case, Your Honor, is that whether or not this court is going to accept this type of response to a public health hazard, because this won't be the last time that a product is on the market in which studies come out or something comes out that says your product is killing people. Your product is killing 300,000 or 400,000 people a year. And the question is, what type of response should a person, a manufacturer, have to that? I mean, should they take the position that our product is not injurious to health?
But you agree the dangers of alcohol are common knowledge. So we can start with that benchmark.
I agree that alcoholism. I agree. Now, Your Honor, if, for example, an alcohol manufacturer or a butter manufacturer had carcinogens in their product that could be removed, would this court expect them to remove it? I think so. I think that the court would expect them to make a less dangerous product, to do what they could to make a less dangerous product. And that's what we're claiming, is that they could, that is that the product they sold was an extra long unfiltered cigarette which he became addicted to and which killed him.
Are you making a distinction between alcohol and cigarettes, the dangers associated with, as I heard you say, there's no safe cigarette, but there may be safe consumption levels of alcohol?
There is a distinction in the record, John. And that's from, I believe, Dr. Grabowski. And I think he talks in terms of, and I'm sorry if I don't remember the exact quote, but it is in fact that something like that not all people who drink beer in college, say 10%, become alcoholics. And that's not true with cigarettes. You know, if you start smoking at a young age, the percentages are vastly different. So we're talking about a tremendously different product. I mean, I don't think it's fair to compare alcohol to cigarettes. But there are other examples of corporate behavior which could have been undertaken. For example, in the Tylenol case, when it was learned that Tylenol was contaminated, that company acted promptly. They warned the public. They took the product off the shelf. They did something to correct their problem. Now, instead, if the American Tobacco Company, instead of starting in 1953 with this press release, which kind of set the standard for the entire industry, if they had, in fact, done the opposite and warned the public, I think we would have a different situation today in terms of lung cancer risk, the addiction, and the damage that has been caused. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
On design defect, as this court wrote in Shears, you have to show a feasible, safer alternative that would have avoided the injury. All of the testimony in this case is there is not a safe cigarette. He would have gotten lung cancer no matter what cigarette he smoked. They haven't made it on design defect. What they're trying to do and asking this court to do is through a risk utility analysis ban an entire class of products. It's the same, and that was discussed in Shears, and it was also discussed by Judge Buckmeyer in the Patterson case when they were trying to outlaw Saturday night specials. Somebody got killed in a convenience store with one, and so they sued the manufacturer, and they wanted to ban or outlaw these Saturday night specials through a risk utility analysis, with the analysis being the risk posed with using a gun like this far outweighs any kind of utility. But Judge Buckmeyer held in that case, as this court mentioned in the Shears case, that it's a political decision, and to do that would be a misuse of the tort process, and banning an entire class of products like they're trying to do with cigarettes here, it should be left to the legislature.
Wasn't there testimony by one of their doctors that the product could have been designed in such a way that the possibility of the plaintiff in this case incurring cancer would have been reduced?
That was Dr. Ravenhall, Justice Abbott, and that's just what I was getting ready to read, what he said. He said, I don't know that one could produce a cigarette that really would be without the capacity to cause cancer, and that's a transcript 1022. And under Shears in the Boatland case, that is not a safe or feasible alternative that would avoid the injury.
Mr. Cruz, by taking your argument, the decision in Cipollone, it seems to me, would be a U.S. Supreme Court determination that at least Congress has looked at the issue whether or not cigarettes ought to be banned or shouldn't be banned. They just decided we'll let the public continue buying these cigarettes. We're just going to make sure that there's a warning put on the cigarettes to warn them that it's going to be out there. But because they've done that and they've expressed their preemption, not every state cause of action is preempted. So there's still going to be some cause of action. Haven't they really, I mean, you argue it in the big picture, gee gosh, don't let a court decision ban the sale of cigarettes, but doesn't Cipollone specifically say that there are going to be causes of action for injuries, harm that results from smoking cigarettes that are still within the domain of the common law and state law in terms of assessing damages for harm that results? I mean,
I don't think just because there's a United States and Supreme Court decision on preemption, what is preempted and not preempted under the Labeling Act, I don't think you can go from there and then say, well, because they're saying everything isn't preempted, which of course is what they did say. They said some are, some are not. But I don't think, if I understand you correctly, you can then go to each state and each state's law and say, just because they say this isn't preempted, that means under I and J that they don't apply, if I understand you correctly. I hope I did.
Well,
I don't think the preemption decision has anything to do with whether or not under the common knowledge doctrine we should win as a matter of law.
There's some tension in your position, though, which is, as I understand it, there's no safe cigarette, but not everybody knows that and nobody can prove it. There's some tension there that makes this a difficult case.
I don't think it would be tension, Justice Hecht. I think it's that's why tobacco is listed in comment I. I think the reason why you shouldn't be able to sue for cigarettes is because the dangers, and the dangers in this case, the risk of lung cancer, were common knowledge. That's what I says, and it lists three examples of products that are not unreasonably dangerous, one of them being alcohol that this court has already ruled on in the Seagram's case, and the other one is tobacco. And Dean Prosser, who was one of the drafters of the restatement, he was asked about comments I and J and with regard to how they would apply to tobacco. And this is on page 18 of our application. Comments I and J were intended to protect manufacturers of cigarettes and other products with well-known dangers from being held liable to consumers. Similarly, Dean Keaton said from the standpoint of what the court should do, whiskey and cigarettes should be indistinguishable. That's what we're asking this court to do. Treat them just like the examples in the restatement. And treated just like you did in the Seagram's case. Thank you very much.
One question.
Yes, sir.
Since this is an addiction case, why should we not look to pre-1969 with regard to whether or not there were adequate warnings?
I'm not following you. I'm sorry.
1969 is when the labeling requirement came out with regard to warnings, correct?
Well, there were labels, warnings in 66. All 69 right. Is when preemption starts, right?
And with regard to the preemption issue, with regard to warning in general, since this is an addiction case, since he was addicted before 69, since he was addicted before 66, since he began smoking a decade before that, why should we not look to what the warnings were at the time that he began smoking?
Well, I think what you have to look to is the common knowledge. That's what we're here asking you to do.
I'm not talking about that issue. I'm talking about the warning issue.
Well, if it's common knowledge, there's not a duty to warn. I may be...
I follow. Sure.
And that's what we're asking this court to hold. And one of the documents in the handout that Mr. Gauntley gave you talks about recent reports on experiments with mice have given wide publicity to a theory that cigarette smoking is in some way linked to lung cancer, and that it talks on the other page, this is in the 50s, that, excuse me one second, during the past year, some statements were widely publicized claiming a relationship between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. These are the kind of things, along with Comet I, along with the decisions of the other courts, the Pemberton case in Tennessee that followed 402A, which was an alcohol case, and the Roysden case followed that, dismissing a tobacco case on the grounds that it's not common knowledge. Those are the things that we're asking you to look to in making your decision on common knowledge, along with our alternative grounds that are in our brief that deal with design defect, that he wouldn't have heeded a warning, and no reliance and, on the breach of warranty also.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All rise.